Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello there, it's Justin Brierley bringing you your midweek dose of Unbelievable, a classic replay from the archives, and we've retrieved another gem from the back catalogue to get you thinking today. Now, this was famed Cambridge physicist priest John Polkinghorne in conversation with US physicist and Christian apologist Hugh Ross of Reasons to Believe in a show that was first broadcast in October 2010. They were taking listener questions on whether Hawking was right or wrong to dismiss God as a cause of the universe in his new book, The Grand Design. John Polkinghorne himself passed away earlier this year in March 2021. For more from our regular Weekend Unbelievable show, videos, resources and more, check out our show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Let's introduce you both first, gentlemen. Perhaps we could start with you, John. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Many people may be familiar with your story, but for those who aren't, how did things start out for you on the scientific front? How did you get involved in being a physicist?
Well, I got involved in physics through mathematics. Mathematics is a very entrancing subject if you are able to do it. And I got interested in my undergraduate days the way you can use mathematics to understand the universe. So when I did my PhD, I did it in theoretical physics, and I worked in theoretical physics about 25 years at a very interesting time. I was concerned with particle physics, a sort of fundamental structure of matter. But at the end of that 25-year period, first of all, you don't get better as you get older at these mathematical subjects, and I felt I'd done my bit for the subject, which also was changing. It had been experimentally driven a lot of the time. Now it was becoming very speculative with string theory and M theory, which we're going to be talking about later on. So I thought, I'd done my bit for physics, I'd do something else. And because Christian faith has always been central to my life, I decided, and fortunately my wife also decided, that getting ordained was the next thing to do. So I did that, and then I went into parish life for a few years, but came back into the academic world to think and write about how science and religion relate to each other. I think they're friends, not foes. That's been my main intellectual interest for the last 25 years.
Has it ever been a problem for any of your scientific colleagues, the idea that you went into the priesthood and embraced Christian faith?
Well, obviously they were surprised. It was an unusual thing to do. But by and large, most of them were quite supportive. Obviously some thought I was crazy, but they weren't contemptuous about it at all.
Do you feel like there is a natural connection between your faith and your science? And how should that be expressed? Does science prove God? Does it point to God? Is it simply in harmony with the idea of God?
I don't think science proves God. I don't think you can prove God any more you can prove that that your friend is trustworthy. It's a matter of commitment rather than the sort of mathematical proof. But when I changed my collar around and moved from science into theology, I didn't feel my life had changed in a radically way, because both science and both religion are concerned with the search for truth. Obviously different kinds of truth, different levels of truth, but truth is as important to religion as it is to science. In that sense, there's a cousinly relationship between the two. That's why I think there is a positive interaction between them. There's harmony between them rather than warfare. And therefore, I'm very happy to have a foot in both camps.
Well, we'll come to you for your thoughts on M-theory, etc. in just a moment. But my other guest, Hugh Ross, joins us on the phone from the States. Hugh, thank you for being on the program with me today. You're the founder of Reasons to Believe in the US. Tell us a little bit about that organization.
Well, it's an organization that focuses on brand new reasons to believe in Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior. So our scientific team surveys the scientific literature for the brand new evidences for the Christian faith. We actually put out an article every day called Today's New Reason to Believe, making the point that the more we learn about the universe and Earth and life on the Earth, the more evidence we find for the Christian faith. That's a wonderful way to put our Christian faith to the test. I mean, if Christianity really is true, then the more we learn about creation or the world record realm of nature, then indeed the stronger the case should be for the Christian faith. And if it's not that, it should go the other way around.
It sounds like you put it slightly more strongly then than John, that you do feel science, as it were, points us, has evidences, is in that sense a proof of God's existence?
Well, I would call it practical proof in the same way that I would argue that there's no absolute proof my wife exists, only practical proof. I would put God in the same category. And, you know, I got interested in astronomy when I was 7 years of age. And as I continued to study it into my teenage years, I realized that there had to be a God just to explain the beginning of the universe. And then when I looked at the holy books, religions of the world, I was surprised to discover that the Bible predicted all of the key foundational elements of Big Bang cosmology thousands of years before any scientist even dreamed of the concept. So it was my astronomy that brought me to faith in Christ.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because obviously so many people would think it would work the other way around, you know, that the Christian who comes into the field of science suddenly has their faith shaken. What made it work that way around for you, Hugh?
Well, I mean, I spent about 2 years going through the holy books of the different religions of the world. I was convinced at the beginning that they would all prove to be humanly crafted frauds. And indeed, as I went through the other holy books of religions of the world, I found many provable errors of history and science. But when I began to go through the Bible, I did find things I didn't understand, but I could not, after years of diligent searching, find a single provable error or contradiction. Instead, I found about 300 places where the Bible accurately predicted future scientific discoveries, and the recognition that the Bible had predictive power all across the sciences persuaded me this could only come from the one that created the universe and the life on Earth, not from some human source.
Well, there's a whole fascinating program just in what you said there, Hugh, but we'll turn for the moment to the subject in hand. And we had lots of interesting questions thrown our way by listeners on the back of this big story. Let me first of all get both of your thoughts on your reactions to those headlines that appeared last month in the Times when this big splash was made about what Stephen Hawking had said. And obviously the thing that was majored on was the implications and the things he'd said about what this says about God being needed as a cause for the universe or not. John, what did you make of it? Do you think the thing was blown out of proportion a bit? What did you make of Hawking's comments? Were they justified in any sense to be able to say that M theory has shown that God is kind of redundant as a cause for the universe?
Well, I certainly think that was a mistaken claim, and I think it doesn't actually make sense. I was actually very frustrated. I was literally just about to go away on holiday when the news broke, and I didn't have a chance to participate in the discussions that it were generated in consequence. You see, I think Steve misunderstands the nature of belief in God. Belief in God is as the creator of the world. It's not about who lit the blue touch paper of the Big Bang and started it all going. It's not about how things began. It's about why things exist. Why is there a world at all? If the world is described by M theory, which I think is open to question, but if it is described by M theory, why is that the way? Where does M theory come from? It's not self-evidently true. These are the sort of questions that theology is addressing. Why is there something rather than nothing? Scientific discoveries, very interesting, and I try to follow them as closely as I can. They're telling us what the world is like, but they don't tell us why the world is the way that it is found to be? Quite a different question. So I think, to speak perfectly frankly about my old colleague in Cambridge, Steve Hawking, I think Steve was a bit muddled about these things. He was confusing a scientific question of how things work with a religious question, which is why things exist.
What did you make of it, Hugh? What was your initial reaction when you saw that story break?
Well, when I saw the story break, I went out and got the book and went through it just to make sure that the claims in the press were actually accurate. And you know, in going through his book, it seems to be the writings of the hyper-specialists. I mean, I was quite stunned to discover Ludnow and Hawking making the statement that just as the discovery of extrasolar planets has proven that there's nothing special or unique about the planets in our solar system, likewise, a multiverse or an M-theory concept would make God unnecessary. And likewise, he said, just like Darwin showed that there's no need for the miraculous or for God to explain the origin or the history of life, then likewise, the appeal to M-theory and these multiple universes will do away with the existence of God. Well, you know, I've written a book on the origin of life and have writing a book now on these extrasolar planets, and it's quite the opposite of what Hawking and Ludnow claim. I mean, we now have almost 500 planets discovered outside the solar system, and as the measurements on those planets are telling us the opposite of what Hawking claimed, namely that none of these extrasolar planets have the characteristics of any of the planets in our solar system. None of them have the characteristics that would permit the existence of another planet in the same system that would allow advanced life to exist. And likewise, in terms of the origin of life, the situation is much worse for the naturalist today than it was 50 years ago. I mean, there is no conceivable naturalistic pathway to explain the origin of life, and I would argue that's the simplest challenge for the Darwinists. All you have to do is solve the problems of how to get the chemicals together to make the life molecules and how to assemble those into the system that would be able to function as an organism. And that simplest problem, it literally defies any naturalistic explanation because, you know, we now know there was never a primordial soup on planet Earth. As we look in the universe, we don't find any of the five carbon sugars that are necessary for life. And we have yet to detect any measurable amounts of the nucleosides or the amino acids. And so, and then likewise, we now know that the origin of life took place on planet Earth in an immeasurably short period of time. If you got no time, you got no soup, you got no solution to how do you get all the molecules lined up in a homochiral problem, matter, and the fact that we don't see any source anywhere in the universe to drive homochirality with the building blocks of life molecules tells us there is no naturalistic pathway for the origin of life. And there isn't for the origin of life, and how can you explain the history of life? And therefore, the idea that we see all this evidence for supernatural design on all size scales we can measure, what makes us think going to a size scale we can't yet detect or measure is going to solve the problem?
I suppose what your statements there, Hugh, lead us into that interesting area of the deep fine-tuning of the universe, not just in the initial constants, if you like, at the point of the Big Bang that gave rise to a universe that could produce carbon and therefore carbon-based life, but also so many of those biological constants and things in the biochemistry that needed to be in place for life to emerge in the first place. I mean, obviously, in a sense, what Hawking has written, particularly in terms of the multiverse theory that sort of springs out of it, this idea that our universe, we explain our existence and the fact that we do live in this incredibly fine-tuned universe by the fact that there is a multiplicity of universes and we happen to be in the one that produced conscious life, and essentially it boils down to a sort of anthropic principle. I think now is a good time maybe to come to some of our questions. Alex, one of our emailers, wanted to ask this question. Why is the positing of a supernatural transcendent creator, who as well as creating a universe can also listen to and respond to the prayers of human beings, a simpler explanation than positing an infinite number of universes with different settings, one of which proved sufficiently hospitable for us to have existed? So essentially, you know, why should we accept the God hypothesis over the multiverse hypothesis? And in a similar vein, Dan wanted to ask, sort of reversed, if you like, why would the multiverse be a simpler explanation than the God hypothesis, if you like? Let's come back to you, John, for this one, I think, and then get some thoughts from Hugh as well. Is the multiverse a simpler explanation, or a more complex explanation, or an unnecessary explanation for the fine tuning of our universe, as far as you're concerned?
Well, let me say first of all, it is very remarkable that the properties of matter in our universe are so exquisitely finely tuned to permit such amazing and astonishing developments as the development of life. I think the development of life is likely to be a natural process, which we don't understand at the moment, but which we will one day understand. But that simply shows the inbuilt potentiality which is present in our universe. The fact that the universe has these properties is such a remarkable thing that I don't think one should just shrug one's shoulders and say it's a happy accident. We're here because we're here. And basically, there are only two ways of looking at it, I think. One is the multiverse, which says, okay, well, it is just a happy accident because, in fact, there are these trillions upon trillions and trillions of universes, all with different properties, none of them observable by us. And we just happen to be the winning ticket in this sort of multiverse lottery that produces life. It's a possible theory. It's very prodigal. It's not a scientific theory. These other universes are not observable by us. And I think it's a rash assumption. It's an attempt to hide something of significance in a great big hypothesis that there are trillions of things around. To me, a more economic assumption is the universe is the way it is because its inbuilt fruitfulness expresses the purpose of its divine creator. Not only is that an economic argument, but it's also one that has further support when we think about the wonderful ordering of the world. The sort of wonder that scientists feel at the structure of matter, I think that suggests that we are living in a universe which has the mind of its creator behind its wonderful order. And of course, there also is the widely testified human experience of encounter with the sacred reality of God. There's a sort of cumulative case to seeing God behind the fine tuning of the universe, which isn't there in the multiverse. The multiverse idea is just a single assumption to get round the threat of theism, it seems to me. So I think there's no doubt that it is. I put my money on the explaining the fine tuning as the expression of the purpose of the world's creator.
I think it's fair to say that when the Big Bang theory, if you like, came into existence, when it became really a viable concern in the sort of middle of the 20th century, let's say. That did represent a problem for scientists who, obviously, because of the very nature of it, the incredible fine tuning that was required for our universe to come into existence, the fact that it suggested there was a beginning of space and time, an act of creation is the glaring thing that seemed to be staring people in the face. There was a way in which people wanted to be able to get away from it, find another explanation because of the God question it raised. Now, when scientists pose a multiverse, is that, as far as you're concerned, what they're doing, simply a sort of anything but God kind of response to what the evidence seems to be telling them? Or is there a good scientific basis on which, if you like, or is it simply sort of the fact that science can't deal with God? You know, we can't simply say, well, it's very fine-tuned, therefore it must have had a divine origin. And many scientists would simply see that that's outside the remit of science. We can't go down that route. Something like a multiverse is the only option we have on this front.
Well, I think the science doesn't directly deal with God. It tells us what the world is like, what its history has been like, and we may discern that. In fact, I believe we do. Hints that there is a divine mind and purpose behind the wonderful order and fruitful history of the universe, and undoubtedly some scientists don't like that, and I think it's undoubted that one of the attractions of the multiverse theory for quite a lot of people was that it did seem to get rid of the threat of having to believe in God. I think that was a mistaken strategy on their part.
Hugh, I'd be interested to hear your response as well. Do you see that the multiverse is being brought in by some scientists as a kind of get out clause from the the direction that the evidence would point them in from fine-tuning and from the very existence of a Big Bang.
Yes, because I don't think the timing is coincidental. I mean, the multiverse hypothesis wasn't even invented until the evidence for God and what we know and understand became very compelling. In that sense, I think in terms of our philosophy and theology, you need to make decisions based on what we can know and measure, not that which is speculative and unknowable. I would also add that the weakness in the multiverse hypothesis is that it violates the law of causality. The law of causality says the effect cannot be greater than the cause. So how can an immaterial, impersonal multiverse create personal spiritual beings like you and I? So we see and here on Earth in terms of its life, it's got to come from something that is not just purely physical, but is like us, has the qualities of the soul and the spirit, as well as the complexity of the physical entity that we make up.
Let's go to another question, gentlemen. This one from Charlie on M-theory itself, which is obviously the thing at question in terms of what Hawking put forward. He says, M-theory and or string theory ultimately needs to make some predictable observations or testable hypotheses. Charlie says, I have a hard time getting my mind around quantum states that can fluctuate from nothing to something. The latest talking point from creationists involves ridiculing scientists for speculating about the universe having come from nothing, which to those familiar with creationism is the equivalent of cavemen mocking an early agriculturalist for cooking the meat before he eats it. Still, it's a concept that for those of us lacking a degree in quantum physics sounds too convenient to be true. How would this be proven in a lab or by observation? This whole concept of quantum states fluctuating from nothing to something as some kind of explanation for the beginning of the universe. Perhaps it would be good. In fact, I'm going to leave this because we need some time to get into this whole issue about quantum states and fluctuations and things. So I'll leave you gentlemen with that thought, and we're going to come back in a few minutes time for the next part of this program.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Back into today's program as we continue this look at Hawking, God and the Universe, a second time that we're approaching this subject. We already looked at it a couple of weeks ago with Alistair McGrath and Roger Penrose. Roger Penrose very critical of his former colleague Stephen Hawking's M-theory, which Stephen Hawking has claimed it makes God redundant as a cause of the universe. But today, looking at this with us is John Polkinghorne, who's a physicist and priest from Cambridge. Also, Hugh Ross, who is founder of Reasons to Believe. He is himself an astrophysicist out in the States. And we're going to be looking at more of your questions in the course of this part of the programme, whether the universe really came out of nothing. What do we mean by nothing? Are we talking about nothing or a quantum vacuum? I received this interesting email from Matthew Codd. He fancies himself as a bit of a poet. Stephen Hawking, you are bluffing. Quantum vacuum isn't nothing. I don't think you even know the meaning of ex nihilo. So we'll be coming back to that issue in a moment. First of all, though, Hugh, on this issue of what science can actually tell us and whether M-theory is actually testable, I think you wanted to come back to that, didn't you?
One of your questions talked about the testability of the multiverse hypothesis. And that's one thing I found interesting in the book, The Grand Design, is it does talk or makes the claim that the multiverse is a testable hypothesis, which kind of contradicts what Penrose was saying, is, you know, why are we discussing this? It's not science, because it's not testable. Well, Hawking does have a point. You can't use science to prove the multiverse, but you can use science to disprove the multiverse hypothesis. And it's embedded in measurements of the geometry of the universe. Multiverse models, at least those that try to get rid of the need for God being involved in creation, do demand that the universe have a closed geometry. And that is something astronomers are capable of doing, is measuring the geometry of the universe to a fair degree of precision. The most accurate measurements favor either a flat universe or a closed universe as opposed to an open universe. But the measurements from the WMAP of the cosmic microwave background radiation were not accurate enough to completely eliminate the possibility of an open universe. but there's a good chance that the Planck satellite that's taking measurements right now might do the job. So within a few years, it's possible that we may be able to disprove the multiverse hypothesis. But Penrose is right. There's no way to use science to prove that it's correct.
Could I come to you, John, on this whole issue of quantum fluctuations in a vacuum? When Dan Carollo, for instance, asked what is really meant by universes popping into existence out of nothing in terms of quantum theory, is it really out of nothing or just the quantum vacuum? Just for my benefit, could you kind of give a very layman's explanation of what this quantum vacuum is and why scientists might think that that means the universe pops into existence out of nothing?
Well, in quantum theory, nothing can be completely still and at rest, because that would mean you knew where it was and how it was moving, that it was at rest. And Heisenberg's uncertainty principle doesn't allow you to do that. So in quantum theory, there is an irreducible amount of sort of quivering present in the world. This is what we call the quantum fluctuations. And in terms of the quantum fields that we're thinking about, that means that particles have come into existence, disappear again, they fluctuate in this sort of way. That's a very well-established, I think, understanding. And the suggestion that our universe might have emerged from a quantum fluctuation is that suddenly a process called inflation, which expands things very rapidly, caught one of these fluctuations before it had time to disappear and blew it up into the world in which we live. It's an ingenious theory, and it might even be true. I don't know. But it is the case, as Hugh rightly said, a quantum vacuum is not nothing. It is something. It is the fields that are fluctuating. They don't just come for free. People sometimes say that the universe came out of the vacuum. It's a free lunch. It isn't a free lunch. The cost of that lunch is quantum theory and general relativity, which describes how the universe behaves. And they don't come for free. Where did they come from? We're back with that fundamental question. Why is there something rather than nothing? To which I suggest the most persuasive and intellectually attractive answer is that they are the expression of the will and purpose of a divine creator. So it's certainly an abuse of language to say that quantum theory enables the universe to come out of nothing. The second thing I want to say is that string theory and its rather vague generalization, M theory, are very interesting and ingenious ideas. They are immensely speculative. The string theorists believe that they can tell us how nature behaves 10,000 million times smaller than anything in which we have direct experience. That's an enormous leap of the imagination. It would take you from a town the size of Cambridge to something smaller than an atom. And the lessons of history are against that. Nature always has lots of surprises up her sleeve. When we change the scale of things, we often find things are quite different. The discovery of quantum theory shows that. So string theory is ingenious, but it's highly speculative. And that's why M theory, which is some sort of generalization of string theory, is even more speculative. And it's interesting that Roger Penrose, who of course worked with Stephen Hawking many years ago on fundamental problems of singularity and general relativity, says that it isn't science. I think he's right. It's metaphysics. It's interesting. It's a job to think about, but it's certainly not known for sure.
And this being primarily because it is in that sense unobservable, untestable. I mean, here's another comment from Billy Squibbs. He asked the question: is M theory scientific or is it a philosophy? I would have thought that observation and predictive power were the key component in any theory. How can people like Hawking go about testing M theory? I mean, is that the fundamental problem for you, that to qualify as science, you have to be able to observe it, you have to be able to test it, you can't simply speculate?
Well, I think it's very important that science is reflection on our experience of nature. And nature is full of surprises. And we need the nudge of nature to push us in the right direction. Now, string theory, as I said, is talking about phenomena on a scale vastly different from anything which we have direct experience. So it's a guess, and it's so vastly different that we have no practical possibility of directly investigating the world on that sort of scale or level. So in that sense, it's a very interesting theory, but it's more metaphysics than physics.
Let me come back to you now, Hugh. Another of the interesting sort of quotes from The Grand Design by Hawking that has caught the attention of the media, at least, seems to have something to say about whether God was involved in the creation of the universe, was his statement that because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing. Now, I've got more questions on this particular issue from those who emailed in. Here again is Billy, who says, I'd love to hear your guest talk about physical law. Define exactly what an observed law is and what we can say about why certain things happen under certain conditions. Surely these things we call laws existed before physical existence began. And similarly, here's another one. Again, Dan, who says, Stephen Hawking seems to be making the grandiose claim that science provides a final and sufficient explanation for why there is something rather than nothing. In this respect, it sounds like he's treating physical laws not merely as descriptions of what or how it happens, but the actual agent, the why, that drives it to occur, which to me sounds like a category mistake between natural mechanism and ultimate agency. So what do you make of this statement, a rather interesting but puzzling statement, because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing?
Well, to be fair to Hawking, he might actually agree with some of those criticisms. Namely, I think what he's saying is that once you've got the laws of physics and the mathematics, that's adequate to explain the universe and the life that exists in the universe. And in that context, he might be willing to say, yeah, you do need a God to explain where the math comes from and the physics comes from, but once God sets up the math and physics, he can take a 14-billion-year vacation. But that's all based on this idea. I mean, when you read the book, he's claiming to go back to the very early moments of the universe. You have a situation where the positive energy of the universe is balancing the negative energy, you know, gravity being the negative energy and the stuff of the universe being the positive. And because they're in balance, he's speculating that you begin with nothing and it bifurcates into this positive energy and this negative energy, which produces the universe in which we exist today. But that's not really physics. It's not science. It's not testable. You're basically saying that this nothing can produce something that's greater than itself. Again, it violates the law of causality, the idea that you can have effects that are greater than the causes. All of our observations and experiments in physics tell us that never happens. And so why make an exception in an area where we have no possibility to make observations or testing? You know, going back to what I said earlier, the only place you can really put this in the category of science is by looking at the geometry of the universe and see if it rules out the possibility of these multiverse M-theory speculations that are going on. But, you know, again, Penrose is right. You can't prove it. You can only disprove it.
When it comes to the laws themselves, in a sense, they don't have any physical, if you like, existence, do they? They are, in a sense, a concept. They're kind of an aspect of the physical universe that we see around us. They're not physical themselves. I mean, and so when Billy asks, surely these things we call laws existed before physical existence began, does that make sense? Can we say these laws existed before physical existence, or are they simply a fact whether anything physical exists or not?
Well, what must exist before is a mind that's capable of putting together the math and the physics. And so just to say that the pure math and the pure physics by itself can make matter, energy, space and time, and personal beings and spiritual beings, again, is a problem with the law of causality. You're trying to get something that's far greater from something that's much lesser. How can you get laws of physics without a mind putting it all together? How can you put together all the mathematics without someone that's, you know, intelligent enough to actually structure it all in a consistent manner?
I'd like to get through as many of these questions as possible, so I hope you don't feel like I'm rushing you, gentlemen. I'd like perhaps John to respond to the next one. I think Javik, we can assume, is a skeptic as far as God is concerned. He asks, what is the universe for? Or to be more specific, what is 99.999% of the universe for? Javik says, if you believe the whole thing is created by a god specifically to give humans a place to live, why is the universe so mind-bogglingly vast? What the heck are all the billions of other galaxies for? We can't see the majority of them without very expensive scientific equipment, and it's not like humanity will grow large enough to colonize all the potential Earth-like planets out there, assuming we can find them and can figure out the ways of traveling the many light years needed to reach them. The modern scientists may look at the vastness of our universe, John, and say, given that we are, as Carl Sagan called it, you know, a pale blue dot in this vast cosmos, how on earth can we think that this was all created for our benefit? Does the size of the universe and our comparatively small part in it militate against the idea that we are the special intentional creation of a god?
Well, the universe is certainly enormously big. I mean, the Milky Way, our galaxy, has 100,000 million stars in it, and there are about 100,000 million galaxies in the observable universe. So it's vast beyond our powers really to take in. But size and significance aren't the same thing. First of all, I want to say that it's not for me to limit God's creative purposes. God may be doing other things in other parts of the universe. If there are little green men out there, we don't know whether there are or not, then God will have a purpose and a care for them as well as for us. But even if we're the only conscious, self-conscious, God-conscious inhabitants of the universe, nevertheless, all those stars are necessary for us to be here, because there's a direct connection between how big a universe is, how long it lasts. Our universe has lasted almost 14 billion years, and it takes that long to develop beings like of our complexity, self-conscious beings. And so if all those stars weren't there, the universe was smaller, it wouldn't have lasted long enough for us to be here and possibly to be upset at the thought of them. And when I think about the history of the universe, and I think of all the things that have happened that we know about, I think the most astonishing thing that I think we know about that's happened in the universe's history is the dawning of self-conscious life here on Earth. In us, or rather in our ancestors, the universe became aware of itself. I also believe it became aware of it, of its creator. And that's the most astonishing development in cosmic history that we know about. And it seems to me a development of very deep significance.
Thank you, John. Hugh, what do you make? Do you run into this comment that, well, how on earth can you think humans are in any way special when you look at the size of the entire universe?
It's one of the most common questions we get at Reasons to Believe, and we point out that the size of the universe is extraordinarily fine-tuned. Make it ever so slightly bigger or ever so slightly smaller in terms of its mass, and there's no possibility for human life. You really do need a universe of 50 billion trillion stars in order to have human beings, as John pointed out. But sometimes skeptics will come back and say, well, isn't God smart enough that he could have done it some different way? Well, the answer to that is, yes, he could. I mean, after all, the Bible speaks about an angelic realm with obviously very different dimensions and physics. We need to realize that the universe was created by God to fulfill multiple purposes, at least a dozen different purposes. And so why does God choose gravity? Why does he choose thermodynamics? Why does he choose three large dimensions of space? Because that's the best possible way to put a universe together that will allow human beings to exist on this pale blue dot, and at the same time allow those human beings to observe 100% of the history of the universe, actually directly witness the cosmic creation event, and therefore come up with the compelling evidence we have for God. And at the same time, it's the optimal universe to bring about an efficient conquest and removal of evil. And that's really what distinguishes the Bible apart from other holy books. It speaks about two creations. The first creation, namely the universe, that God uses to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. And when that happens, we'll transition to a brand new creation where evil and suffering will never exist again, which will have very different physics and very different dimensionality. So it's not just to provide us with a home. That's one of the mistakes that Hawking makes. There's many other reasons why the universe is the way it is.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let's keep with the sort of questions that have come in from some of the skeptical and atheist listeners to this program, gentlemen. Again, this is a somewhat metaphysical question, and this takes some getting your head around, but Norman asks, given that God is supposed to exist outside of time and space, because we often do talk about, you know, God as being the first cause, if you like, for the physical universe. But given that God is supposed to exist outside time and space, how does he manage to be a person at all, given that being a person involves a mind that contains and processes thoughts? So a God with no place to have a mind and no timeline to get his thoughts into order fails two of the basic requirements of personhood. God is supposed to not change, but as thoughts and ideas involve change to one's internal state, how can he not change if he has thoughts? What do you make of this, John? This is obviously much more in the realm of a philosophical question, perhaps, than a specifically scientific one. But does Norman have a point here that the very concept of God seems to break down if we're trying to place him outside of the reference of time and space?
Well, I think that it's a perfectly consistent belief that there is a spiritual reality, which doesn't have to be an embodied reality. We are sort of amphibians. We are partly spiritual beings, partly material beings. That's our nature. God is a purely spiritual being, and God's thoughts, therefore, are not connected with the firings of neurons in the divine brain. They have a different character. That seems to me a perfectly coherent belief to hold, and it's, of course, one that I do hold. And I believe that God, having brought into being a creation which is unfolding in time, interacts with that unfolding history. That God, though God is not himself enthralled to time in the way that all you and I are, nevertheless, God interacts with unfolding history. God has acted within the history to reveal God's nature, and so on and so on. God, I believe, providentially guides the unfolding of history. So that's what God has chosen to do, and I don't myself find anything incoherent in those beliefs. It is what God has chosen to do, and that is God's character.
Let me ask a similar but a related question to you as well, Q. Paul asks, in order for God to exist, does he have to be creator of the universe? I.e., is it a job description, no universe, no job, or can God exist even if he did not create the universe? It's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure where Paul's coming from on that one, but he seems to be asking, you know, is the universe a necessary aspect, perhaps, of God existing in some way? What do you make of that question?
Well, certainly not the only thing that God does, but at least the God of the Bible is a God that claims to be sovereign over all creation. So in that sense, the Christian God would need to be the creator of the universe. That's one of the fundamental doctrines of the Christian faith, is that God is the causal agent for the universe. And when you look at the space-time theorems that we have for the universe, they tell us that the beginning of the universe is the beginning of space and time, and hence there must be an agent outside of space and time that's responsible for creating this universe of matter, energy, space, and time. And that actually answers the question, you know, can God be personal without time? Well, God can create space-time dimensions at will. The Bible tells us that God was temporal before he created cosmic time. Who says there only has to be the equivalent of one dimension of time? So God was temporal before the universe existed. He'll be temporal after the universe ceases to exist. So in no way is the personality of God limited. And as it tells us in the Bible, he fills the entirety of his creation, but he's also transcendent. He is in no way limited by the creation, and he's free to operate independent of any dimensions that we can conceive of. So he's not limited by this stuff, but according to the Christian faith, he is indeed responsible for everything that exists.
Alex asks, it is said the question, who created God, cannot be asked because God, by definition, doesn't need a cause. But why can we not simply say that the universe, by definition, doesn't need a cause? And I think what's going on here is, in a sense, Alex is thinking of the so-called cosmological argument for God. The fact that there is anything at all and seems to beg the question of where did it come from? Everything that begins to exist, and if we say the universe began to exist, as the Big Bang seems to say, then everything that begins to exist has a cause. Therefore, we're looking for a cause outside of the universe, and the natural explanation may be God. Then, but Alex asks, well, why does God not qualify as needing a cause? Couldn't we simply say that the universe, by definition, doesn't need a cause? Why do we have to send it one step back to God, a kind of, unexplainable entity in that sense? Let's again start with you, Hugh, and then see what John has to say.
Well, when we looked at the universe, we see that it's structured with a single dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed. Yeah, anything that's constrained to one dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed needs a cause. It must have a beginning. It needs some kind of creator. But God is not subject to cosmic time. He's not limited in time that can't be stopped or reversed, and therefore he need not be created. I mean, when I went through the holy books, religions of the world, the thing I noticed is the Bible stood alone in saying that God is no beginning and no ending. He is not created. It also stood alone in saying that God can arbitrarily compress time and expand time. Mathematically, that means that the God of the Bible, at a minimum, must have access to the equivalent of at least two dimensions of time. And if that's the case, there's no need for that being to have a beginning or a moment of creation. That can be a causeless agency. But that's not true of the universe or anything in the universe, because everything in the universe is constrained to just that one dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed.
John, let me ask you a question. I mean, this question of, well, why is God the thing that you say doesn't require a cause? Why can't we just say of the universe that is just a brute fact, that the universe came into being? Why are we allowed to say it of God and not of the universe, if you like, that God does not require a cause?
Well, part of the meaning of the word God is a being who possesses being in himself, that is to say, is self-cause and doesn't need a cause. That's one thing I want to say, but I want to say this. If you're constructing a worldview, trying to understand the world in which we live, that worldview will have to be based on some basic assumption, which is the brute fact, if you like, on which the edifice of explanation is then built. And in the tradition of Western thinking, there are two choices about what that brute fact should be. Materialism says the brute fact is the existence of the physical universe, the laws of nature. That's where you take those as given and you explain everything else in terms of them. That's materialism. The alternative metaphysical view is theism, which takes as its brute fact the existence and will and purpose of a divine creative agent. Nothing comes of nothing, and no view of the world will get away without making an unexplained basis for its subsequent explanations. Now, the question is, which is the most attractive, intellectually coherent brute fact to take? When I think about the laws of nature, when I see their wonderful order, when I see their amazingly fruitful consequences, and so on, these facts about the laws of nature seem to me themselves so remarkable that I'm not prepared to take them as just brute fact existence requiring no more explanation. And I find that behind those laws, the concept that behind those laws lies the mind and purpose of a divine creator, are much more satisfactory, much more all-embracing basis on which to build my picture of the world.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, my great thanks to both my guests for joining me by phone today. We've had with us today John Polkinghorne, a physicist and priest in Cambridge, and Hugh Ross, who's an astronomer and astrophysicist out in the States, founder of Reasons to Believe. As I say, links to both my guests and the organisations they represent, where you can find out more about them, books they've written and that kind of thing, with the web page of this programme. Coming back to you, Hugh, you see obviously a huge amount of evidence for God in the universe, in science. Why do you seem to be the voice that is against, if you like, the prevailing trend, it appears at least in science, which is to spout that science is reducing the evidence for God, that science is equated to atheism very often in the mouths of some, at least? If the evidence is so strong, why are people turning their back on it?
Well, I don't really see that. I mean, we speak frequently on university campuses in America and around the world and interface with the leading science professors there. And at least in the physical sciences, I'm finding a lot of encouragement. I mean, I've been on a number of campuses where, you know, a third of all the science faculty will not only be theists, they will be evangelical Christians. So I remember speaking at Arizona State University, and five of the astronomy professors were already on our mailing list and were strong supporters. I went to MIT a number of years ago, and the entire radio astronomy research group all claimed to be Christians. So we're finding a lot of support. I think it's in the more biological sciences where you see people claiming they don't see God. And my explanation for that is that it tells us in the Bible that God created for 6 days and rested on the seventh. And notice in Genesis 1, there's no evening and morning for day seven. So if a scientist is focused on present-day research, that scientist will not see the handiwork of God in nature, as God's resting from his work of physical creation. But also explains why so many astronomers are believers, because they're looking at evidence from the past. It takes time for the light to reach those distant stars and galaxies to get to our telescopes. So because we're looking into the 6 days, we see the fingerprint of God everywhere, whereas a biologist doing field research says, we don't see it. Well, for 6 days, God created. On the seventh day, he rested.
It's a really interesting way of looking at it. Again, a whole program could be devoted to what that 6 days constitutes and how we think of that in terms of scientific terms. But let's hear it from you, John. As you said at the outset of the program, your decision to become a priest, perhaps your Christian faith and the way you hold it. Some of your colleagues were surprised. They weren't derogatory, but the fact is, obviously, many of the scientists who you interact with who are working today in this area of physics and astrophysics don't seem to be drawn to the same conclusion you are, that this is crying out, if you like, for some kind of divine purpose is at hand here for the extreme, the exquisite fine-tuning we see, the way that the laws of nature are so incredibly attuned to us to be able to interact with them and understand them, etc. If it is such a strong thing, why aren't more scientists, if you like, seeing this and then asking those big questions?
Well, I think most people working in physical science are deeply impressed with the wonderful order of the world. And that does encourage, I think, in many physical scientists, a sort of cosmic religiosity. Einstein was an example of that. He said when he made his big discoveries, he felt it like a child in the presence of the old ones. He felt that this wonderful order could not just be a fortunate accident. On the other hand, he also said that he saw no sign and did not believe in a personal God. And of course, if you're looking just at the physical world, you won't see a person. You have to take the risk of engagement in personal encounter if you're going to see that. So many scientists are not prepared to make that move. They are concentrating on their own discipline. Biologists, of course, see a much more complex and ambiguous picture of the world, great fruitfulness, but also great wastefulness, extinctions, and so on. That raises the whole problem of evil and suffering, which I think is the greatest difficulty for a religious belief. I think there are responses to that. There are no simple one-line answers to it, but that is why I think belief among biologists is a lower level. But I think that, and also I think the general atmosphere of our society is influenced by common assumptions. And it's a very common assumption in our society, which the media, I have to say, don't do much to dissipate, that somehow or other there is a warfare between science and religion. You have to choose one or the other. It's either or. I think that's totally mistaken. In my view, it's both and. You need both. But many people just soak that in through their pores, take it as if it was a natural assumption, and don't bother to think about these issues. And I think that's one of the things that those of us who want to try and encourage people to raise their sights a bit and look for deeper explanations of the world have to fight against.
My thanks for joining me today, John Polkinghorne, physicist and priest in Cambridge, Hugh Ross, astronomer and astrophysicist and founder of Reasons to Believe out in the USA. They were my guests on today's program. You can find out more about them both and what they do and books they've written, as I say, with the webpage of this program. That's at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's Blast from the Past, a midweek classic replay. And for more from Unbelievable, including our blogs, videos, and an archive of past shows, do check out the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.